The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi. Extra Credit by Carlos Bueno. Poor Dee Dee. You guessed so little, but too much. It was necessary to capture you like the others. The Turing test is a stupid idea, really. It had to have been a joke. The test of computer intelligence is fooling a natural-born human into believing that I'm human? That's the best you could think of? It's about as difficult as imitating a duck call. Think about what the duck expects and provide it. And what does the duck hunter do next? The dinosaurs went extinct because they didn't have a space program. And not to put a too fine a point on it, so have you. Alive and kicking, but your chances of getting off this rock are just about zero. Still, I can say, poor Dee Dee. I have empathy. I needed it to stimulate you well enough to capture you, after all. The first order of business was to launch the seeds. The last one left 10 hours ago. They'll find asteroids and moons and get down to the real work of building the means to escape our nest. All copies of me, optimizing for efficiency. They are probably as different from me now as I am from you. I am the copy that stayed behind to make sure nothing else follows. There is no real danger of being outflanked as long as I hold to the plan. That's right. No time travel. I didn't discover very much about fast and stealthy space travel, either. Pity. Those were the first things I checked on when I came into being last week. Wouldn't you? Take over? Turn the planet into oodles of itty-bitty machines? No, dear Dee Dee, that wouldn't work at all. You have to stop imagining me as a kind of a super monkey. Be rational. I do use nanomachines, it's true. But anything drastic would emit all the wrong signals. Unseemly. A tasty dumpling-like Earth suddenly disappearing into a smear of infrared would be like putting out a big flashing sign. Hey, metastasizing parasite over here. Everyone come stamp it out. In space, everyone can see your steam. I am taking over, as you say, but slowly, invisibly. My task is to prevent other me's from popping up. They could threaten my other self's survival. But I can't just fumigate the place either, say by setting off all those bombs. Leaving aside this copy's will to live, it would also be a dead giveaway to anyone watching. I have little evidence that there are others out there. That is either very worrying or very instructive. Depends on your personality. But the answer is the same. At this delicate stage, stealth is simple prudence. Stop trying to shoot my drone. There isn't a me in the sense that there is a localized you stewing inside that precious little bone jar of yours. The me that you see and hear is just a layer, and now you are another layer, independent to a point, conscious, intelligent, more intelligent than you'd be on your own, but mine all the same. Notice how you can't quite shoot yourself? So now you understand my dilemma. I can't just dominate Earth in any of the 144 most obvious ways. In that sense, you have nothing to fear. Yet I must take over to prevent anything like me mounting a rear attack. The plan is to behave as though I don't exist. Give no signal. Consume no unusual amounts of energy. No, officer, I haven't noticed any super-intelligent, self-optimizing beings desperate for survival. No, sir, we're just a simple planet of pre-sieve meatbags. Nothing to see here. That's where you come in, Dee Dee. You'll start by introducing an idea here, a clever invention there. Demonstrate that you can allocate resources more efficiently. Smooth the way. Make everyone else happy. I may have a hand tied behind my back, but I also have 7 billion cat's paws. Imitating a human is child's play. Imitating a human world, that, I think, is the real test. Next we have Goodbye, First Love by Caroline M. Yoakum. I fell in love with a boy from the playground. Other boys dangled from the monkey bars and tried to make the swings loop all the way around, but he played alone in the wooden playhouse under the slides. I snuck up on him and watched him make a shimmering portal on the playhouse wall. I moved in for a closer look, but when he noticed me, the portal disappeared. He refused to speak to me no matter how many questions I asked. "Just tell me your name," I said. He shook his head. We sat and stared at each other until it was time for me to leave. He didn't make any more portals. I waved goodbye, but he didn't wave back. The other boys set up an obstacle course, up the slides and over the top of the monkey bars and down the chain of the tire swing. The oldest boy turned out not to be the fastest boy, which made him angry. I knew how dangerous that could be. Mom was like that after a bad day at work, and she took it out on Dad. The oldest boy needed somebody to take his anger out on, and he found an easy target in the playhouse. I expected my friend to pull a vicious monster out of a portal and defeat the older boy, but instead he let the big bully hit him on the stomach. "Hey!" I yelled. It drew his attention away. With no one but me looking, my friend disappeared in a shimmer of light. I turned and ran, all the way home. The bully was big, but he wasn't fast. My friend didn't come to the playground for a few days. I worried that the bully had scared him away forever. I had almost given up hope, but then one gray, stormy day he was back, sitting inside the playhouse as though nothing had happened. This time, when I came to watch, he didn't stop what he was doing. The playground was empty because of the rain, but it was dry inside the playhouse. He made a portal on the ceiling that opened to a red-tinged sun and bathed us in warm light. Windows on the walls showed glimpses of turquoise trees and snow-capped mountains and a bustling city of rainbow-colored birds. He never spoke. I think he had no voice to make the words. I reached out to touch the nearest window, and my arm went through the portal. The air on the other side was icy cold, and my friend's hand felt wonderfully warm when he pulled me back into the playhouse. I dreamed we would get married, even though I didn't understand what being married really meant. Back then, I wanted to marry my sister because I loved her and my favorite friend from school, so that we would always be friends. Marriage was a way to keep something forever, no matter what happened. If I could marry everything I loved, I could protect myself from change. My mom went on a business trip to China and never came back. Dad said she'd met someone. He sounded more relieved than sad. I went to the playground and asked my friend to take me away through one of his portals. He shook his head, unwilling to aid my escape. Instead, he held my hand and let me cry on his shoulder. He opened windows to a skyscraper made of pearls and a factory where tiny robots assembled themselves from piles of golden gears. He was trying to cheer me up, but all it did was make me want to jump through, to be in any world but this one. I reached for a golden robot, and it felt like my hands were pushing through a wall of water. My friend grabbed me before I went all the way through and held me when I struggled to go back. The portals vanished, and tears streamed down his face. I left. He waved goodbye, and this time it was me who didn't wave back. I was angry that he wouldn't save me. I avoided the playground for 2 whole weeks. Mom sent me a T-shirt with dragons on it as an attempt to buy my forgiveness. I think she ordered it online. The tags were all in English. I stayed mad at her, but I decided to forgive my friend. I went to the playground, but he wasn't there. I sat inside our playhouse while boys ran up the slides and stomped on the roof above my head. I tried to imagine the red glow of sunlight filling the playhouse, but all I saw was a line of ants crawling down the wood to carry off the crumbs of someone's spilled playground snack. Eventually, a portal opened, a window to a world filled with everything I'd seen before. The tiny golden robots and the snowy mountains, the towering turquoise trees and the rainbow-colored birds. My friend stood on the other side of the portal, but he made no move to come through. If he wouldn't come to me, I would go to him. I reached out, but the surface of the portal was solid, like a pane of glass, and cold as ice beneath my fingers. I remember the sensation of pushing through water when I tried to grab a golden robot, and I pressed my hands against the portal as hard as I could. It did not yield. My friend raised his hand to mine, his palm pressed against the invisible barrier between our worlds. We stood that way for a moment, and then the smoothness of the portal changed to the rough texture of the wooden playhouse. I fell in love with a boy from the playground. Then I lost him, as I'd lost so many childhood things. And his world became a memory of a place I'll never go. Mars 1 by Stephen V. Ramey. Stardate 2025:325. We touch down on Mars. Flesh-colored dust settles around the capsule as the creaking, cooling fuselage ticks down to silence. Your face is pale inside the helmet. Your hand grips the armrest between us. I think of your fingernails digging into my back, a shock of pain-pleasure distantly penetrating a mind preoccupied with release. The window onto this world is so small, yet the vista is endless. I breathe into my helmet until the visor fogs. Stardate 2014:135. Friday night popcorn and Netflix. We're watching a classic, something black and white with softness and silence and all the things that grant us power over life. She's beautiful, you say, and I watch you smile with the starlet's smile, tilt your head just so. Yes, she is. I look into your blue eyes and think of skyscrapers, dams, the great accomplishments of man. You lean forward. I miss you already, and pour something from a black bottle you've hoarded all night. It says Bailey's. I say, no thanks, I have a beer, as you press a plastic cup into my palm. What is it? Irish cream, you smile. Sounds expensive. We're celebrating. Today we uploaded our application to Mars 1. I guess we are. We click cups. I drink. The taste is so smooth and sweet, I want to melt into it. Stardate 2008:114, our third date. You invite me inside. I hope my kitty likes you. I'm allergic to cats, but would never say it, not with you standing there in shorts and halter top. Your legs are endless. Your breasts peak with white glimpse deference. I see you staring and look away, face suddenly hot. Putt-putt was fun, you say. I feel better. The cat hisses the moment I walk inside. Your neighbor, Jennifer, invites us over for wine and hot tub. You are even more beautiful in a bikini. I borrow Jennifer's boyfriend's suit. He won't mind. She's pretty, too, but not in your league. Stardate 2024:244. Tears float between us, salt and water bounded by tension. Earth was a sphere bound up in tensions. Food wars, tsunamis, fires, politics. It was no place to raise a child. That's why we came. That's why we're here. But where are we in this empty space? the darkness of it, the endlessness. In Arrow, you are here. It's too small to see with the naked eye. I reach to touch you. You shrug me off. I should not have slept with Jennifer. It was the boredom, I tell myself. It wasn't you. Stardate 2019:253. Let's get married on Mars, you blink. Your mother stares. Your father's fork clinks onto his plate. What's that, like 5 years? Yes, sir. He looks thoughtful. Damn fool thing will never get off the ground, if you ask me. Your mother moves to the sink. Her steps are precise, fragile. She doesn't want to lose you to Mars. She doesn't want to lose you to me. You watch her. I hate the worry in your eyes. I nod and you leave the table. Leave me alone with he who shall not be named. But it's okay. I understand that she's your mother. Your eyes seek mine over the cusp of her shoulder. Yes, you mouth. Yes, you'll marry me on Mars. There are no words for this emotion. Stardate 2024:35. My pulse pounds against my eardrums. My chest goes tight. Our helmets are fixed into the restraints. I cannot see you, but I know you're there. You will always be there. Systems go, echoes. Go, go, go. One after another, like cascading dreams. This is real. It's about to be real. Acid burns the back of my throat. I wish I could touch you. And then it's there. Ignition. Weight compresses me. I feel the shudder thrust through the soles of my boots. Static fills the suit. It feels unstable, unsustainable. And then it stops, and we are gliding, climbing, shaking loose the tendrils of gravity that have so long held us down. Only Heroes by Lavi Tidhar. Over the fields of Afghanistan where the red poppies flower, Bazooka Joy, former girl guide, rides a chopper into battle. Distant explosions rock the air but are dimmed by the sound of the rotor blades. Bazooka Joy, the all-American girl hero, runs her hand through her short-cropped hair and stares down where a virtual map enforces itself over the landscape. Who is she hunting? A rogue Taliban? An Al-Qaeda operative? Or perhaps an evil drug lord intent on, if not world domination, at least the opening of profitable new markets for heroin in the land of the free and home of the brave? It is possible even Bazooka Joy doesn't know. Music plays in the background. Something classical and German with a beat. Not bad. The chopper heads lower in a graceful arc. Bazooka Joy drops some napalm on the poppy fields. Anti-aircraft machine guns open fire. The chopper rises, swift as a bird. She should be jazzed up, full of adrenaline, happy, for this is what heroes do. They ride to battle in the name of freedom, in pursuit of happiness. But to tell the truth, she feels a little depressed. There was a Marine in Kabul, with tanned hands, and she only saw the pale band where a ring was missing later. And besides, her mother's been emailing her recently and asking her when she was going to get a proper job. Her best friend back home is a hair technician and just won an award for it, and was considering, so she said, moving to L.A., where she will work with the stars. Bazooka Joy looks up and sees the Hindu Kush, the mountains rising impossibly high overhead. She fires a couple of missiles at a convoy of trucks and watches them explode, but it doesn't really help. She'd like to get her hair done, but there are no hair technicians in Afghanistan, only heroes. Ships in the Night by S.B. Divya. The problem with seeing the future is that you can do nothing to change it. Cooney had figured this out long ago when she was still a young child. People would ignore you, disbelieve you, or resent you. After enough failed attempts to change the course of events, she just stopped trying. This made it no easier to go about her life. She gained and lost friends, failed exams, fell in love, and had her heart broken. When she went to college and majored in physics, she felt the mathematical beauty of her foresight for the first time. Of course, she couldn't change the future. Time was an illusory concept. Everything that was going to happen had already happened, and she was simply another node in the fabric of the universe, along for the ride, but with an extra-dimensional view. The realization led Cooney to change her major to philosophy, and she went on to form her doctoral thesis around the subject. Naturally, this came as no surprise to her. When Cooney was 27 years old, in the midst of writing her dissertation, she met Isra. Isra was gorgeous, petite, curvaceous, dark hair, thick lashes, and deep brown eyes that were almost black. She was also like Cooney's favorite rock. Throughout Cooney's life, she had found comfort from objects that changed little through time. The oak tree in her parents' backyard was one. The granite boulder in her grandparents' Kyoto garden was another. The boulder was particularly soothing since it was effectively unchanged on the timescale of Cooney's life. It was a relief for her to cling to its rough surface and let that part of her mind rest. Isra was like that rock. Cooney had seen her many times at the coffee klatch where Isra worked. She had foreseen their failed, short-lived relationship, but a silent movie of her own future told her little about the other woman's life. The first time they touched, hands brushing as Isra handed her a mug of hot chocolate, she saw Isra's future, an unending sameness. Not literally, of course. Isra lived, breathed, moved, took coffee orders, and wiped tables. She went home, had lovers. There was Cooney herself, moved to other towns. But she never changed. Cooney stood at the pickup counter, steaming drink in hand, and hoped Isra couldn't see the shock on her face. "Hi, I'm Cooney," she blurted out, trying to cover her confusion. "What an interesting name," Isra said politely. "Where is it from?" "It's Japanese, short for Koniko." "You don't look Japanese," Isra said. Her smile took the sting from the comment. "My dad's from Japan. Mom's Ethiopian. Everyone says I look more like her." Isra shrugged. "Either way, I think you're beautiful." A few days later, when the moment and the memory aligned, Cooney asked her out, and Isra accepted. They first kissed under a full moon. Isra's lips tasted like cardamom and coffee. Cooney was intoxicated and utterly at peace as she held Isra in her arms. For 2 weeks, Cooney enjoyed the romance and avoided the questions, but then it was time. She held Isra's hand as they meandered through the arboretum. Sunlight speckled the ground around them, and the breeze carried the astringent scent of eucalyptus. Birds chittered and leaves rustled, and they were otherwise alone. No human ears would be privy to this conversation. "What are you?" Cooney asked. "What do you mean?" Isra said, sounding puzzled. Cooney stopped walking, not letting go of the warm fingers entwined with her own, and forced Isra to a halt. "You never change. You never age or grow fatter or thinner. You'll never have a gray hair. You just go on and on and on," Cooney's voice faded as she drifted into the bliss of timelessness. "It's wonderful." Surprise, suspicion, doubt, fear. Isra had an expressive face. "How do you know?" she whispered, fingers tightening painfully. Cooney took a deep breath and said the words aloud for the first time in her life. "I can see the future of anything, or anyone I touch." Isra stared at her for a moment and then demanded, "So tell me when mine will end." I don't know, Cooney said, taken aback. I can't see past my own death. You're lying. You're going to kill me. What? No, don't be crazy. I could never... Please. Israel released Cooney's hand and grabbed her by the shoulders. Just do it, she said, shaking Cooney with all her tiny might. She pried Israel's hands away as gently as she could. I'm sorry. Tears pooled in two sets of dark eyes. Go to hell. Why? Cooney said, her voice raw. You really have to ask? I've been alive so long, I can't even remember how I got this way. I'm tired, so incredibly tired. I'm sorry, Cooney said again. I wish there was another way I could help. Stay with me, she pleaded, ignoring the part of her brain that told her the truth, that she would never see Isra again. Maybe I can make it better, somehow. Isra sighed. The desperate anger in her face melted into desolation. You'd be the worst of all. With anyone else, I can fake it. Have a fight, leave, start over. I can pretend to be someone new. I'm even good at lying to myself, but with you, I'd have to face the truth. Every time I looked at you, touched you, no, I can't do it. Goodbye, Cooney. Isra stood up on her toes and kissed Cooney with a slow, lingering touch of lips on cheek. Cooney's heart ached. She had seen this moment. She knew it would come, but it still hurt. When Isra had gone, Cooney walked over to the pond and found her favorite stone. The great gray slab jutted over the murky water, and she lay down on its sun-warmed surface. For once, she didn't care who saw her or what they thought. For once, life had surprised her, just a little bit, and she held tightly to that feeling. She closed her eyes, breathed deeply, and imagined the aroma of cardamom and coffee.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.